Welcome back. Jesse Larner is back with us. He's the author of the book Mount Rushmore, An Icon Reconsidered. When we started this conversation with Jesse a couple of days ago, we got as far as the tangled political history of Gotsen Burglum, the sculptor who carved the faces onto Mount Rushmore. His previous work included working on a Confederate monument in Georgia, reputed birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan, which raised funds for that monument. What we were just beginning to talk about, a conversation that you can join, by the way, by calling us now at 1-800-433-8850 or emailing us at kojo@wamu.org, was the choice of site. Mount Rushmore, who owned the land then and why a legal dispute persists today. Jesse Larner, welcome back, this time by telephone.
Hi, Coach. It's a pleasure to be back.
Glad to have you back. How was the specific area for this project picked? Many may not know that the Black Hills area was considered special to the Lakota tribe who lived in that region, and the area itself has a complex history.
Yes, one of the things I really try to get into in the book is the background to how that part of land actually came to be part of the United States. And in fact, that is one of the many layers of irony on the story of Mount Rushmore, that this shrine to freedom and democracy is planted in the middle of land that really was quite illegitimately taken. It was taken by abrogating an important treaty of 1868. There is a continuing land dispute about this. Starting back in the 1920s, the Lakota Sioux tribe began a lawsuit with the federal government to get full payment for the value of the land as it was known to be in 1868, in 1877, when the land was taken by the federal government after gold was discovered in the Black Hills. And under the law, they could not sue for any value of the land that was discovered subsequent to the taking, but they could sue for the underestimation of the value of the land at the time of the taking. Now, this is a very complicated lawsuit. It was the longest-running lawsuit in the history of the United States, and it ended up in a judgment in 1980 that the tribe was entitled to the extra value of the land as it was known to be in 1877 for an assessment of $17 million, plus interest since 1877 for a total of $117 million. The irony of this is that by the time when the suit had started out in the 1920s, all the tribes were quite united in their desire for monetary compensation. By the time the suit was actually settled in the 80s, or what not settled, but there was a resolution, this was no longer politically possible. There had been a real revival of Indian consciousness and identity, and the tribe was no longer interested in monetary restitution. They wanted the actual land back. And since 1980, the value of the settlement has been sitting in a bank and has grown to about $500 million. But no one is willing to touch it. They won't accept this money. And this is quite extraordinary, I think, because...
The tribes won't accept the money. What do they want?
They want compensation for what was taken from them in terms of their way of life, and they also want the actual land in the Black Hills back that was granted to them by treaty. Obviously, it's not very realistic that they could get half of South Dakota and parts of Wyoming, Nebraska, Montana back as tribal land.
But it raises an interesting legal question. If the tribes are refusing to take the money, does that mean that they do not acknowledge ownership of the land by the United States, and can that challenge be made in court?
No challenges can be made anymore in court. The last decision was a Supreme Court decision, and as far as the government is concerned, the issue is closed. But that's not so as far as the various Sioux tribes are concerned. And this is very much a live issue in South Dakota politics, and it really affects the way that people live their political and social lives in South Dakota to this day.
I remember reading where you said earlier that the guides at Mount Rushmore do not know much of the history of Mount Rushmore. What do they know?
Well, they kind of know what they're told to tell, you know, about how this is a great monument to the accomplishments of these presidents, which it isn't exactly, technically, and about how this reflects...
Why isn't it technically a monument to the accomplishment of these presidents?
Because the official theme of the monument is the foundation, preservation, and expansion of the United States, and these presidents are there because of what they did to help that theme, not in terms of their personal character or accomplishments as presidents.
We got an email from Howard in Washington who says, I was in South Dakota last year and was amazed that the Crazy Horse Monument, about one-third complete, literally dwarfs Mount Rushmore. All of the Mount Rushmore sculpture would fit on the shoulder of Crazy Horse. Does your guest agree that the Crazy Horse Monument has sort of set the record straight about the history of the West?
Well, I think that's a very complex question. The Crazy Horse Monument is quite controversial among the Lakota people themselves. There's a question of, you know, a lot of Lakota people feel that blasting up a mountain to in tribute to an individual is a real desecration. And there's the irony of doing this for an Indian hero as well as for any other kind of hero. There's a question of whether Crazy Horse himself would have wanted this. He was a very interesting personality who felt a great sense of duty, apparently, to his people, but was not particularly personally ambitious or egotistical. Furthermore, no one really knows what he looks like, since he assiduously avoided ever having his image taken while he was alive. And the project was begun at the request of a Sioux elder, Henry Standing Bear, although it was carried out by a former assistant of Gutzon Borglum and his family. A lot of Indian people object to it, and they object to the fact that the excess money that the Zhukovsky family is raising in South Dakota for the project, that there are some doubts about how this money is being spent, that there are plans to invest it in a Native American university and things like that, but this is not so far materialized.
So you're saying that Gutzon Borglum is also linked to the Crazy Horse Monument?
The Crazy Horse Monument was begun by his assistant, Korchak Shukovsky. By the time he began it, he had had a very severe falling out with the Borglum family. In fact, had gotten in a fist fight with his son, with Borglum's son, Lincoln. So they were not on very good terms, but yes, one project did in a way grow out of another because Henry Standing Bear decided that there ought to be an Indian monument too. As I said, I'm not trying to imply that all Indians are opposed to the Crazy Horse Monument. In fact, some are quite enthusiastic about it and supportive, but there is that split. There are those who do not feel it's an appropriate way to honor their own heroes.
Jesse Lawner is author of the book Mount Rushmore, An Icon Reconsidered. Jesse, what does Mount Rushmore represent to you now?
Well, it represents all kinds of things. I think, to me, it's a shame that most people don't relate to it in terms of its complex history. I think it's quite legitimate to look at it as all of these good things, a monument to the best of America, to freedom and liberty. But there are these other things, too, and they don't go away. And I think in order to deal with Mount Rushmore honestly, you have to be aware of them and to know what you're looking at. I mean, Gutzon Borglum was a lifelong white supremacist, for instance, and this is one of the ironies of Mount Rushmore. And you can't, if you don't know that when you look at Mount Rushmore, you don't know what you're looking at. I had an opportunity once to ask Dan Wink, who was at that time the superintendent of Mount Rushmore, whether there was ever going to be an exhibit there about Gutzon Borglum's Klan affiliations. And he said that he didn't feel at this time that the American public is ready for that, whatever that means, but that he wouldn't rule it out for the future. He also said he had some understanding of why the monument is objectionable to American Indians.
Well, if the guides at Mount Rushmore are not familiar with the complex nature of the history that you describe in the book, some people would feel that the book, Mount Rushmore, An Icon Reconsidered, should be available in the park gift shop at Mount Rushmore. Is it?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I should find out. There's an excellent book about Gutzon Borglum and Mount Rushmore, Howard and Audrey Schaff's Six Wars at a Time, which does touch on his clan affiliations, and that is on sale in the Rushmore bookstore. I think it lets him off the hook too easily. I mean, the Schaffs go to some pains to point out that he was using the Klan for his own political purposes, and they also say quite incorrectly, I think, that in those days the Klan was not as much of a hardcore racist organization as it is nowadays. But I think they do tend to sort of play down the significance of this affiliation. But they do mention it, and they're one of the very few people who have written about Mount Rushmore who do mention that. Usually they tend to avoid the subject for obvious reasons.
We got an email from Mark in Bethesda, Maryland, who writes, "My father is from South Dakota, and I worked my high school summers on my uncle's ranch. My cousin and I always spent a week in the Black Hills at a camp that included a visit to Mount Rushmore for the night lighting ceremony. One of the local tourist traps," says Mark, "is the Rushmore Cave, and we always got a rise out of the tourists by claiming that the cave was where they stored the monument during the winter. A surprising number of folks fell for it." I don't know if you have any comment on that, Jesse. I guess Mark was simply trying to tell us about his experience.
Well, it's an interesting anecdote, I know.
But how can you avoid the tendency that people all over the world have to look for monuments or other artifacts that can be used as a kind of shorthand for what is great about that particular country? Here, a lot of people use Mount Rushmore as kind of shorthand for what's great about America. How do you avoid that by trying to point out the complex history and at the same time depriving people of that shorthand that they so often need?
Well, I think sometimes the full story is more interesting than the shorthand. I think that's what drove me to write about Mount Rushmore in the first place. And yes, Mount Rushmore is this recognizable icon. But there's a danger in that. There's a danger of giving symbols too much power. I would like to tell a more interesting and complex story and get at some of the irony behind it. And I think for my purposes, I was delighted to see that an earlier segment of the show was about the Czech Republic. As I go into in the book, Gutzon Borglum was affiliated with a lot of political movements, one of which was the Czechoslovak liberation movement near the end of the First World War, that was lobbying for an independent national state of Czechoslovakia, something that had never existed before. And he actually wrote the Declaration of Independence for the Czech movement. And in that declaration, he wrote, "We cannot accept rule by alien people." And he also wrote, "Our culture has only survived with great struggle and great pain and great sacrifice." And I think there's an irony to this, you know, in that he could well have been, those words could well apply to the Lakota people who were conquered and colonized in South Dakota. And that also is part of the history of Mount Rushmore.
So you're accusing Borglum of having a double standard in this situation. Why do you feel that somehow he found it unacceptable in Czechoslovakia, yet somehow acceptable in South Dakota?
Well, I wouldn't call it a double standard because I think that implies some kind of consciousness. I think that it would never have occurred to him. I don't think it entered his consciousness in any way.
Why not?
Well, because he was committed to the story of Manifest Destiny and the idea that it was right and just and necessary and inevitable that the people of Europe would sweep into the New World and bring their civilization and their culture with them, and that this was all to the good. He was not unaware of the injustice done to American Indians, and in fact, he lobbied very hard on their behalf, and he contributed, he made great efforts and contributed much of his own personal funds to alleviating famine on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and he did write extensively at length of the injustice done to the Indians. However,
as you point out, it can be very complex. Jesse Larna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jesse Larna's book is called Mount Rushmore, An Icon Reconsidered. The Coach Onandi Show is produced by John Haas, Terry Cross Davis, Detanya Towner, and Sam Gallant. Diane Vogel is the managing producer. Our engineer is Joe Gill. Dori Annesman has been on the phones. I'm Coach Onandi.
I'm David First.